Welcome to SNC's podcast series, SNC Critical Insights. Today we're speaking with Frank Aquila, a partner in SNC's M&A group and member of the firm's management committee. As we return from summer vacations and head into September, it's time to think about what's on the horizon for M&A in the coming months. What forces are at play? What industry and regional trends should we expect to see? And how will current geopolitical and economic events impact deal-making in the first half of 2020? All this and more will be discussed in today's conversation. Frank, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ron.
Frank, how would you describe deal-making in the first half of 2019?
It has been an interesting period. Certainly, the last few years has been a particularly busy period for deal-makers. I think what I would say is that we had anticipated that 2019 would be a bit of a continuation of what we saw in 2017 and 2018, but given trade wars and tariffs and some of the factors like Brexit, cross-border M&A has decreased significantly. Eurozone M&A has decreased a fair bit. And so what has happened is that M&A activity here in the U.S. has really been the driver. And in fact, what we've seen is that it is the mega deals that have really been carrying M&A activity. And anybody like myself who's been around M&A for 30 years plus, you know that you have a really good M&A environment when you're seeing the $20, $50 billion deals, but you're also seeing the $5 billion deals, the $1 billion deals, the $500 million deals. And we're seeing the mega deals, and that's keeping the totals fairly robust, but we're not seeing the smaller middle market to smaller deals getting done.
Thank you. So what regional trends do you find the most noteworthy thus far?
Again, I think the lack of cross-border deals, the drop in deals within Asia, the drop in deals in Europe, certainly the UK is a bit of a frozen market at the moment. Let me explain that. Everybody had expected Brexit to happen March 31st. And so a lot of deals in 2018 were put on hold. Let's see what Brexit is going to look like. Let's see what the rules are going to be about trade into and out of the UK. And come April 1st, we can resume negotiations, have a better sense of value of non-UK companies to UK companies and UK companies to non-UK companies. That has now been put off to October 31st. So, as I say, UK M&A activity is down. In Asia, China has been a real driver of M&A activity over the last few years. For various reasons, they've been tightening on the outflow of capital in recent periods. So that's been falling already with the tariffs and the trade war with the U.S. That has gotten even worse. I think the tensions and problems in Hong Kong are making that even a tougher situation. So we're seeing very little there. I think the bright spot out of Asia is Japan outbound. And I think what we're seeing there and we will see increasingly is that Japanese companies, given the fact that they are in an economy that is low growth to no growth with very little prospect for domestic growth, and these are companies that have significant cash on hand, can borrow effectively at zero, that they will be continuing to do a lot of acquisitions, some in Europe, some in places like Latin America and elsewhere, particularly for commodities. But The market that they really seem to want to be in is North America, specifically the United States. So I think we'll see a lot of inbound activity from Japanese companies to the United States.
Thank you. Frank, can you talk more about how these global and regional trends have impacted cross-border deal-making?
Yeah, I think that by and large, we've seen a lessening of cross-border activity, not just this year, the last few years. And when you pull back and you look at the political environment in a lot of places, and the U.S., you know, is certainly a good example, where the political message seems to be very nationalistic, very populist. We're seeing that certainly in the U.K. with Brexit. We're seeing it in places like Italy. We're seeing it certainly in the United States. Seeing it when you look at what's behind Xi's rise to power, and he's obviously taken on much more power than recent Chinese leaders. It really is building the Chinese state for something very, very permanent. So, you know, when you have this rise of populism, the thought of cross-border deals coming in and a non-local company taking over your national champion and taking that technology, potentially taking jobs, all of that is something that is going to be seen as quite negative. I think, you know, even in the EU, we've seen that when Italian companies make bids for French companies, there's fierce opposition. And supposedly, the whole point of the EU is to have one common market, but yet you're still seeing very much nationalistic trends there. So cross-border M&A activity, and we clearly have seen deals, we will see deals, but I think we have to recognize that right now there are headwinds for cross-border M&A.
Very interesting. Thank you, Frank. Have the private equity markets been impacted at all?
Well, first of all, private equity today is very different from the traditional model, the Bill Simon, Wes Ray model of the late 70s and early 80s for private equity. And if you go back to that period, basically the model was you would take a company, cut out costs, pay down the debt, and resell it in 3 years and have a great return. And that has really changed, you know, in terms of their acquisition model. But more than that, a lot of private equity money is used today for buying debt, taking stakes in public companies, and things of that sort. Private equity companies have more firepower, more capital than they've ever had before. They have the ability to borrow at historically low rates, whether it's here or elsewhere. And so they've been involved in more deals by value, although you're seeing them in less deals, because for them to participate in an M&A deal, they're going to have to pay up. So they're going to have to pay more for an M&A deal because the strategics that they are competing, first of all, they're competing against themselves, but then again, they're also competing against strategics that are dealing in a low growth environment, who have a lot of cash, have the ability to borrow at even lower interest rates than they do. So they're paying up, but buying less. But again, they're also doing things other than just M&A.
Thank you. What industries have seen an uptick in activity despite the global drop?
The one industry I want to focus on first and foremost is financial institutions. And I want to talk about that because of the fact that really from 2008, and in 2008, which was the Lehman crash, and we saw a lot of activity in 2008 and I guess some in 2009, but that was really distressed M&A. And you saw banks taking over other banks and investment banks taking over investment banks. But those were quasi bailouts, quasi whatever. But there was a real reshaping of the financial institutions community during that late 2007 to, you know, let's call it the first half or so of 2009, with most of the activity being in 2008. But since then, there's been virtually no, at least no sizable activity with respect to financial institution M&A, and particularly large bank M&A. We started the year with the SunTrust BB&T transaction. We had the First Data Fiserv transaction. We represented principals in both of them. We've been involved in other transactions, but we haven't seen the volume of transactions that maybe we did in the 90s or the early 2000s, but we are seeing a regular flow of financial institutions deals. So I think that's quite notable. Healthcare, that has been a constant theme. There are years when we see less and years when we see more, but we should all remember that in the first quarter of 2009, when no one was doing any M&A activity and you really couldn't borrow to buy a car, even if you had great credit, Pfizer and Merck were doing, you know, $50-60 billion acquisitions. So healthcare is a big driver of M&A activity. Energy and power, technology, those have been big drivers. In the TTM space, we saw Viacom and CBS. Viacom and CBS is, to some extent, a special situation. The Redstone family was a controlling shareholder of both. Viacom and CBS were once the same company. They split them apart. Then they brought them back together. It wasn't so simple to bring them back together, but nevertheless, they did. So, you know, those are the sectors that have been particularly active. I think they will continue to be active. I also think we're going to see more in retail. Retail is undergoing a dramatic, dramatic change. A lot is talked about in terms of the loss of jobs in the coal industry. The reality is, and I don't have the numbers, that the number of workers in coal from 2000 to 2019, it's a big drop, is nothing in compared to the loss of workers in the retail sector. The difference is that coal mining and mining in general has affected one or two spots in the United States and devastated the economies of those communities. So it's gotten a lot of attention. The reality is that retailing is something that exists in every single town, every single city in the United States. And it not only affects the retailers, it affects the suppliers, whether it be whatever industry is selling through the retailer. So it affects those employees. It affects the real estate. The company, you know, you walk around any town, you see a lot of vacant stores. You walk around Manhattan, you see a lot of vacant stores. So there's going to be a shift in real estate. There's going to be a shift in retail. And so we're going to see combinations there. Consumer packaged goods, because of the combinations in retail, because of the fact that some of the companies that are now dominating the retail channels, whether it's online digital retailers or big box stores, are going to, and they're squeezing the margins of the consumer packaged goods companies, are going to lead to combinations there. So those are some of the trends that we're going to see, not just in the balance of the year, but I think for a couple of years to come.
Frank, what specific challenges would you say that companies face in the current political and economic environment?
I think, you know, uncertainty is the phrase that I would say. A big part of my practice is, and for a variety of reasons, I've spent, and I do spend a lot of my time in boardrooms. In a typical month, I'm in board meetings of four or five different companies, and they're in different industries, different sectors. And so I get a good sense of what boards are concerned about. And they're concerned about the consequences of trade deals and tariffs. They're concerned about labor shortages. They're concerned about regulation, deregulation. They're concerned about the U.S., particularly as we limit immigration, becoming, you know, in a low birth rate, an aging population, which will lead to, you know, you want 3 or 4% growth. Well, if you limit your population and you have an aging population, you're building in low economic growth. And that means that companies are going to find it harder and harder to grow. And if you wind up with low organic growth, and you've already spent the last 10 years since the fiscal crisis really cutting costs, the only way to grow both your top line and your bottom line is to consolidate, is to do deals in your sector or in adjacent sectors where you're going to have synergies. And as a consequence of that, you're going to see deals, and I think we're seeing it, where you're going to have a high degree of regulatory review. We're seeing, unlike the Reagan period, and a lot of people thought, well, the Trump administration will be just like the Reagan administration, very pro-business, and we've certainly seen that in terms of rolling back regulations in certain areas. But the reality is their antitrust oversight has been more like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama than it was like Reagan and Bush. And you'd say, well, you know, why is that? How could that be? The reality is that if you're a populist, you're not really a pro-business conservative. So they're looking at these quite closely. And also the difference is in the early 1980s, most industries really hadn't started to consolidate or had just started to consolidate. Whereas now the industries are further along in the consolidation process. And so there was quite a bit of antitrust review.
And Frank, one last question. What does deal making look like for the rest of 2019 and into 2020?
I'm very optimistic about deal making in 2019. I think there's a lot in the pipeline. I'm hopeful as people come back refreshed from summer holidays that a lot of deals that have been moving fairly slowly throughout the year, people will want to get done. I think what we may see is, at least in the first half of 2020, that people will want to get deals done and get them through the FTC and the Justice Department before there's a change of administration. I think that's a wise thing to do, because what happens is that if you do a deal in the second half of an election year or the first half of a year after the election, there's going to be change at the Justice Department and the FTC. And, you know, when I say that, people say, well, you're assuming that there's going to be a change in administration. And I'm not really predicting who's going to win the election. All I know is that typically what happens is that people sort of stay for the first administration and they say, okay, I've gotten my credential. I was, you know, whatever for 3.5 years or 3 years. Now I'm going to go back to private practice or whatever I was doing before. And new people come in. And some of these, and we saw this at the beginning of 2017, where these agencies were frozen for a period. And so I think it makes sense to get deals done over the course of really the next 12 months and get them approved and done by the end of 2020. So I think the first half of 2021 probably is a slower period, but I think if people are wise, the next 16, 17 months could be a very busy period.
Very interesting. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com.